coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Reading Consortium on Educational Equity is offering its initial recommendations on how to address longstanding inequities faced by Delaware's neediest students.
It's important to understand that the consortium isn't making any radical recommendations. They consist primarily of expanding existing programs while accelerating the implementation of projects that were scheduled to start a couple of years from now.
Contributor Larry Nangis joins us to discuss these recommendations. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at volunteer opportunities in the First Aid ahead of this month's MLK Day of Service. Arts Playlist tells us about a project that aims to provide affordable housing to artists in Wilmington. And Enlighten Me highlights new research on the impact of methane gas in salt marshes on climate change. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. At the same time, schools across the First State prepare to return to hybrid learning next week as they continue an academic year dominated by the COVID-19 pandemic. The group tasked with addressing long-term educational inequities faced by Delaware's neediest students is moving ahead with its efforts. The Reading Consortium for Educational Equity offered its interim recommendations to Governor John Carney last week. What Carney does with them will likely be affected by the settlement reached last fall in the state education funding lawsuit. The Carney administration is required to make a number of educational investments by that settlement. So what is the Reading Consortium suggesting? And how much of its plan can the state realistically try to implement? These are questions contributor Larry Nagengast examines in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found. So before we look at the recommendations themselves, can you tell us about the group's co-chairs, State Senator Tizzy Lockman and former Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor Matt Den, and what they had to say in the report's introduction? They did not pull any punches there, did they?
Yes, indeed. There was no mincing of words in this report. In fact, after I printed out the document and started reading it, I highlighted a half dozen powerful phrases on the first page alone. I'm sure we'll get into some of those details later in this conversation, but a couple of points do stand out. First of all, Matt Den and Tizzy Lockman point out that the state's return to neighborhood schools in northern Newcastle County 20 years ago created a system of racially identifiable high-poverty schools that was far worse than what the critics had predicted in 2001. Now for the attempts to support children in these high-poverty schools over the past two decades, they state bluntly, these efforts have failed. Time after time, they point out, the state has come up with partial solutions, seen them fail, and replaced them with yet another partial solution, and that in turn would fail. The result of this cycle of failure is that for an entire generation, significant numbers of students, not only in Wilmington, but also in other high-poverty areas of the state, have been shuffled through 13 years of school without getting the education that they need to become productive members of our society.
Having said that, what are some of the key things that they are recommending to avoid being the latest incomplete effort at addressing these issues? And beyond that, what's the price tag for making these things happen?
Well, let's do the price tag first. Add it all up and we're in the neighborhood of $16 million additional for the fiscal 22 state budget. And if they go whole hog on this, it could be up closer to $30 million. However, it's important to understand that the consortium isn't making any radical recommendations. They consist primarily of expanding existing programs or accelerating the implementation of projects that were scheduled to start a couple of years from now. For example, for children under 5 years old, the state has a program that surveys children for their kindergarten readiness, but it doesn't have the money to reach out and survey all of these children. It has several home visitation programs that target families that are living in poverty, but it doesn't reach all of them. And the state has talked about free pre-kindergarten programs for 3- and 4-year-olds for years, but it hasn't implemented them yet. So now there's also been plenty of talk in the last 5 years about developing a system to improve the recruitment, retention, and training of teachers in high-poverty schools, but that hasn't happened yet either. There have been numerous initiatives around what is called outside school time programming. These are projects that run before and after school or during the summer, as well as wraparound services, things like school health centers, assistance to families, and so on. If you go back 10 years to the federal Race to the Top grant, some of that money went to programs like these, and there were a few successes, but most of these programs died when the money ran out. Taken together, I can say that there's very little here that hasn't been talked about before. But right now, the consortium is delivering this message about getting these programs going with a brand new sense of urgency.
As your piece points out, these recommendations aren't the only thing for Governor Carney to consider as he crafts his budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year. He has also made commitments in the state education funding lawsuit settlement that was reached in the fall. Is there anything that could be considered kind of overlapping between those two things, or are these recommendations basically somewhat in competition with those settlement commitments for state funding?
Well, no. As I said, some of the consortium's recommendations are accelerations of programs that are in the works, items that pretty much resemble things that are committed to in that settlement, but that are a couple of years down the road. For example, when the governor agreed to the settlement in the finance lawsuit, one of the promises was to add at least $6 million in spending to early childhood education starting in fiscal year 2024. The consortium is recommending spending about $8 million more a year on these programs, but they want to start it this year, not 2 years from now. Similarly, the consortium's recommendations on professional development for staff in high-need schools at a cost of $1.2 million this year would amount to a one-year early start on a project that would start next year, a year later, under the terms of the lawsuit settlement. So we're talking here about an acceleration in many cases of things that the governor has or pledged to do starting a couple of years down the road.
Governor Carney has often turned to one-time or short-term allocations to address issues, including education, in an effort to remain fiscally responsible. How readily can that approach be used with these recommendations, or are these things that are going to really need new ongoing funding to work long-term?
Well, let's work with that $16 million figure that I gave you, and you realize that that $16 million, it could turn into something in excess of $20 million if they develop more than the minimum number of wraparound services that the consortium is recommending. Anyhow, the $16 million is a rough recommendation, a rough estimate of what these recommendations would cost that next year. And that's less than 2% of the state's annual spending on education and a very small fraction of a state budget that's likely to be in the neighborhood of $5 billion for the next fiscal year. So, it's reasonable to think that the governor could build $16 million or so into the budget as a one-time appropriation. Also, with regard to that school finance suit settlement, the only increased spending for the coming fiscal year is an additional $10 million in opportunity funding for students in high-need school. The other spending that's being pledged in the settlement won't kick in for 2 years from down the road, and some of it is actually phased in over a longer period of time. So, in that context, I think adding $16 billion to the budget is something that would be doable. What we don't know, however, is how well the optimistic revenue estimates that the Delaware Economic and Financial Advisory Council, DFAC, provided last month will hold up in the spring when the state budget is actually being finalized.
So how much does the changing face of the General Assembly play here? Are these recommendations likely to find more supportive voices, and could that make a difference in what happens going forward from here?
But, for now, I'm going to say yes. And we've talked about this before in the context of the settlement for the school finance suit. The new members of the legislature are generally younger and generally more progressive than the individuals that they replaced. In addition, Tizzy Lockman, who's the co-chair of the Reading Consortium, has moved up to a leadership role in the Senate Democratic Caucus. Representative Kim Williams, who's another consortium member and an education reform advocate, has been given a seat on the Budget Writing Joint Finance Committee. So we've got a few strong players in the education reform arena who are now playing larger roles in the legislative process. And that could make a difference. But, you know, hey, it's early January, and we've got 5.5 months to go where anything can happen before the legislative session ends.
So the Reading Group was also looking at other issues beyond what we see in these recommendations. What's still left on the table for the group to work on?
Well, you know, there are a lot of items on the consortium's plate, and all we've talked about so far today are the top priorities that have a price tag attached to them, items that have to be brought to the attention of the governor and the General Assembly now so that they can be incorporated into the budget discussions. You know, but there are at least two items that the General Assembly will be hearing more about in the next couple of months. The first is a revised version of a bill that was pushed a couple of years ago by former Representative Earl Jakes that would give school boards a limited authority to raise property taxes without going to a referendum. Now, some school board members and some school districts like this idea, but the Delaware School Boards Association does not. So we can expect some more discussion about that this spring. The other significant item is how to restructure the school districts in northern Newcastle County so that there are fewer boards with roles within the city of Wilmington. You know, and that's a remnant of the desegregation court order from the 1970s. The consortium was supposed to, under its enabling legislation, prepare a proposal for the State Board of Education to consider by the 1st of April of this year. But the COVID-19 pandemic became the top priority last year for the school administrators and board members who were primarily assigned to work on this project. So as a result, the consortium members who serve in the General Assembly are going to have to introduce legislation in the next month or so to extend that deadline. That's likely to mean that it's going to be another year before we hear great detail about how the districts that serve the greater Wilmington area might possibly be realigned.
So I want to go back and finish by looking at what State Senator Lockman and Matt Dent said in their introduction to this report. It expressed frustration that these issues remain unresolved after multiple attempts to address them. Do you sense that this frustration is more acute now, that those involved in the Reading Consortium are less likely to take no for an answer or wait for an answer, especially as the pandemic has kind of thrown some of these inequities into starker relief?
I think the answer to your question is yes. The members of the consortium are less likely to take no for an answer this time around. But as we all know, the pandemic has changed a lot of things. Many people are still working from home. Government agencies are having meetings via Zoom instead of in person. Students are learning remotely, and they're going back into that hybrid mode next week. So the pandemic has thrown all of these inequities that impact low-income and minority students into much sharper relief. And it has also complicated the efforts to come up with solutions. So the bottom line here, there's ample evidence today that the urgency to create solutions is greater than ever. And to me, that suggests that real solutions are more likely to appear now than would have been the case a year or two ago. However, because of the pandemic, it may taking a little bit longer than we had anticipated to be able to actually put these solutions into place.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece on the Reading Consortium for Educational Equities, Recommendations, and Where They Go From Here is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at what's going on in the first date later this month for the MLK Day of Service. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is January 18th. Since 1994, the holiday has served as a national day of service, encouraging Americans to get out into their communities and volunteer in honor of the civil rights leader. Many organizations here in Delaware rely on volunteer support to protect the environment, save lives, and help those in need. And as Delaware Public Media's Roma Battaglia reports, for many groups in the First State, the Martin Luther King Day of Service is more than just a day.
On January 18th, we have a National Day of Service, which highlights Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. So this Day of Service focuses on giving back to your community. There's a quote that Dr. King has that talks about everybody can serve. No matter what walk of life you're in, anybody who has a heart to serve can be a service.
That's Kanani Munford, Senior Administrator of Volunteer Delaware. The state agency connects people with volunteer opportunities throughout the state. There are hundreds of nonprofits and community organizations in Delaware, focusing on every aspect of life in the state. Many nonprofits run tight ships. They operate on small staffs and rely on the support of the community to help them achieve their goals. One nonprofit in southwest Sussex County, the Nanticoke River Watershed Conservancy, depends on a volunteer base to protect Delaware's natural lands for future generations, says Marlene Mervin, director of the conservancy.
We just have one staff, and that would be me. but we do have a 10-member board of directors and quite a few volunteers.
The Conservancy owns a little over 500 acres of land around the Nanticoke River, meant to offer wildlife habitat, walking trails, and improve water and air quality in the region. Harry Brake is one of the board members of the Conservancy. He says visibility of the organization and educating Delawareans about the lands available for them to use is really important.
We had a cleanup day, a community day, a couple months back, and so that was really... It was overwhelming because we had, about 21 or 22 projects that actually got completed. And that's the first time, but we got a little taste of seeing like a lot of people don't know what happens, at the Nanticoke, and they don't realize a lot of these resources are in their very own, in their very own community.
The role of a volunteer is wide-ranging. At the Blood Bank of Delmarva, volunteers not only greet people when they come in and hand out refreshments after a blood donation, says Tony Prado, communication specialist at the organization.
Every single one of our donors, blood donors, is a volunteer. That's per FDA regulations. If a nurse hangs up a bag of red blood cells, you'll see volunteer blood donor on that bag. And so when you think about it, volunteers comprise the bulk of our operations.
For many people, the MLK Day of Service is a way to get out and do some good for their community. However, many organizations see that one day as just a starting point to introduce people to the world of volunteering, says Munford.
So you're introduced to a great opportunity on January 18th. Great. But we want you to stay involved. We want you to continue to volunteer. So we can educate you on ways to get involved in the community, and then you can sign up to be a volunteer long term. And so that's ultimately what, from the State Office of Volunteerism's perspective, we want individuals to continue to volunteer in our community. So this is a great springboard, a great day to potentially be introduced to serving our community, but we want you to stay involved.
Munford stresses the need for volunteers this year-round. While some groups, especially ones that work out in nature, hold big events to clean up the river or plant native species, other organizations, like the Blood Bank of Delmarva, can't. Angela Williamson is the volunteer coordinator with the Blood Bank.
We're not like a beach cleanup where you can have 100 people show up and work on one day. So the Blood Bank, we need people to make their appointment. So MLK Day would be a great day to put in a volunteer application, or before or after, put in a volunteer application, set up their appointment to donate blood, come help us out in whatever way, shape, or form they can.
Some groups don't even have the capability to hold events on MLK Day, regardless of a global pandemic. Nivette Perez Perez is the volunteer coordinator with the Center for the Inland Bays.
Now, normally the January and the winter season is a little slower for us, and because we are in the planning stages of all the programs that are to come for the very busy spring, summer, and fall. So normally MLK falls in these odd time of the year when we are trying to report from last year and also kind of present a little bit about what we're going to be doing in the next year.
The MLK Day of Service offers that opportunity to highlight the important work nonprofits do in the state and show people how to get involved with them. Volunteer Delaware is planning a virtual event all day on the 18th. bringing together organizations like the Blood Bank of Delmarva, Code Purple, and Heart Art to show people how they can start volunteering and ways to help their community from home. Heart Art will be hosting a virtual card-making party to send Valentines and goodie bags to veterans for Valentine's Day. The agency will also host an awards show that night, recognizing individuals and groups that have made significant contributions to the community. Break from the Nantico River Watershed Conservancy is also hosting an event.
And we're one of the organizations that has a 30-minute spot that day. And it's just to highlight different opportunities that are volunteer, that individuals in the community would be able to participate in the theme of Martin Luther King, you know, giving back to the community, promoting each other, promoting diversity.
Breaks is a big goal of presenting on MLK Day is to provide visibility for the organization. Showing people this resource available to them in their backyard will help the organization when they need volunteers to help. One thing that's been great for many organizations' visibility is the COVID-19 pandemic. Breaks says because more people are looking for ways to be outside and get some fresh air, they've discovered many of the trails the Conservancy owns. Perez Perez from the Center for the Inland Bays says they've also seen a lot more people visiting.
The other part that many people are very excited too, and now with COVID-19 we have seen an increase in visitation, is our stewardship in the James Farm Ecological Preserve. This is the James Farm Ecological Preserve is managed by the center, and because of COVID, we haven't seen increasing in visitation, people looking at ways to connect with nature, relax, walk, get out of their houses. So we definitely have a lot of opportunities for people to learn more about the James Farm, and some of these volunteer opportunities are, for example, we are organizing tours, so volunteers can help us lead those tours. We do litter cleanups, we do invasive species plant control in the James Farm. Grass cutting, and the possibilities are endless. Like I said, we always try to match the interests of the volunteer with the projects that we offer.
And Munford notes the timing of MLK Day of Service at the beginning of the year makes it a great way to incorporate service into a New Year's resolution.
As you are preparing for great things in 2021, let volunteerism be a part of your goal setting. Choose a organization that you're passionate about. You know, find the cause that's important to you, then contact the organization or go to our volunteer website, which is volunteer.delaware.gov. Go to the website. Most likely your organization is there. And then you can find out how you can give back to your community.
Mumford adds there's lots of ways to volunteer, and people can commit as much or as little time as they'd like. Plus, there are also opportunities to volunteer remotely because of the COVID-19 pandemic, some of which Munford hopes to present during her agency's virtual MLK Day of Service. Roman Battaglia, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Roman. A reminder that Roman Battaglia is our Report for America Fellow. And the Green continues in a moment with Arts Playlist and a look at a project in Wilmington that seeks to make affordable housing available to the arts community. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware's arts community is still reeling from the COVID-19 pandemic. Museums, galleries, and theaters remain shuttered or limited by the virus, leaving many artists, writers, and dancers out of work and looking for other creative outlets. Now a state nonprofit behavioral health services support provider, Connections Community Support Programs, is building, preserving, and converting three existing apartment buildings and one commercial building in Wilmington that will offer that group some help. The Quaker Arts Project will include 53 affordable housing apartment units, and those involved in the arts will get first preference for them. Connections Community Support Programs Communications Director Teresa Buchanan joined Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist to discuss the project and how it dovetails with continued development of the Creative Arts District in West Center City.
Teresa, thank you for joining me today. Yeah, happy to be here.
Hey, talk to me about Connections. Give me some background first.
Connections, actually, we're one of the largest nonprofits in Delaware. We our services are pretty vast and varied. We're a leading nonprofit behavioral health service provider. We actually work with folks who have developmental disabilities, who have substance use disorders, some reentry programs, transitional type programs, and programs for homeless vets and their family.
All right. So the reason I wanted to talk to you on the show today was because Connections Community Support Programs, Inc. has officially now kicked off the construction, preservation, and conversion of the Quaker Arts Project. What is the Quaker Arts Project?
Well, it's actually part of a larger project that the Creative Arts District in West Center City is kind of initiated with Wilmington Renaissance Corporation and Wilmington Alliance. They're trying to sort of revitalize that area and make it an area for, you know, the creative arts and to actually bring up the neighborhood. So, you know, we're helping by sponsoring these buildings and the renovation of those and the renaissance of those by offering affordable housing, but mainly to people involved in the arts, which will kind of dovetail with what they're doing there in West Center City.
So expand more on this. How did this project come to be and involving the arts?
Well, Connections has other affordable housing facilities, okay, and that's really the main reason why this has come into existence. But what we wanted to do is be a good steward of the neighborhood as well, and be part of the Creative Arts District and Wilmington Renaissance. So that's why we're sort of the way that we're revitalizing these buildings is, you know, we're sort of providing. Well, there's like 53, I think, apartments. Like I said, especially preference to those involved in the arts. There's going to be, you know, creative studio space, art studios, a computer lab for, you know, written word artists, multi-purpose rooms for dance artists, music rooms. There's also going to be a community garden, which I'm really excited about, being a community gardener myself. And a tot lot, some meeting rooms, kitchenettes to have functions outside of COVID, of course. And we've got a lot of great partners that are involved with us. You know, Delaware State Housing Authority, Alliant Capital, NCAL, Synair, Energize Delaware, Federal Home Loan of Pittsburgh. And we've been in partnership with DeSabatino Construction Company before, too, on our recent Penn Place opening, and we're excited to be working with them again on this project. And I think it's going to be really great for the neighborhood as well as for the folks who need the housing.
How will you identify these artists?
That's difficult to say. The property itself is going to be managed by another organization working with the Housing Authority, you know, who will draw up that criteria. That's not really for Connections to say. They have a better idea of how we can identify folks who are in fact artists. I don't think you can show up with a drawing and say, I'm an artist, I need affordable housing. But I'm sure, you know, students recently, graduated students, et cetera, will, or people who have a history of being, you know, trying to make it as an or any kind of artist actually will be, like I said, looked at and given first preference.
So where do we stand with the project right now?
Well, they really just started. I mean, it was cleaned out and looked at, redesigned by Architectural Alliance and DeSabatino Construction. And they tried to figure out with us how we could make the most efficient and creative use of the space to provide what artists need within that facility. So, like I said, 53 units, but they're all kind of divided with different resources offered to different arts.
Was any collaboration done with arts organizations or artists to see what indeed they do need?
Honestly, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but I could. I'm sure there was, because, you know, working with the Creative Arts District at Wilmington Renaissance and Wilmington Alliance, they have a really good idea of you know, what's required, what's needed in the area, what's missing.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, you mentioned a community garden. How important will this be now more than ever with, you know, food insecurities because of COVID and things like that?
Well, that's why I'm a big personal proponent of CSAs and community gardens, because I think that that's something that's really taken a hit over the last couple decades, is people knowing where their food comes from and what the best thing is to eat. If you look at some of the statistics on those folks that have the worst diets, the highest instances of diabetes and obesity, it's usually in an area that's lesser served or that's below a certain income level. And I think that's because cheap food and fast food is easy, and they really don't get the education and the hands-on understanding to know how to create their own and how to, you know, get the best, possible food in their bodies and the bodies of their kids. And I think this will help a lot with that.
Help me understand, if you will, the Quaker Arts Project concept. Like, how was that name? Is this already a concept that is out there, or did you guys arrive at that name for some other reason?
No, it's already out there, yeah.
Okay. Can you explain?
That's the district. They named that area the Quaker Arts District. So for connections, it was just our contributions to the project were our Quaker Arts Project.
I gotcha. So when do you think the project will be finished and the artists can start moving in?
Well, it's slated for December of next year, barring any complications. Although I can't imagine how there would be. A lot of times there are things that stall projects that are outdoors. But this is already, these are buildings that are already constructed and it's more of an interior renovation. So I would imagine it would be just about a year and a couple months.
Any word from residents in and around that area when you started this whole thing and, they found out that it was going to be artists and it was going to involve this community garden and things that you've already mentioned? Any word from area residents that they think this is a great idea?
Honestly, we've gotten nothing but positive feedback, which is great. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is because, the project itself and then afterwards, we're filling the units with people. It provides an increased demand for local jobs and for businesses, it raises property values. And hopefully when that happens, crime gets reduced. The buildings aren't abandoned anymore. People want to be there. So I all we've heard from day one is, positive, happy feedback on it.
Yeah, and to fill this building with creative people who have creative energy in a time when, we need a little bit more creativity and positivity, I think this
Absolutely.
Will be a great project. What am I not asking that you want people to know about the Quaker Arts Project?
Honestly, I don't know if there's any other details that are missing. I'm personally really excited to see what they're going to do with this place because, like you said, people with a creative energy, writers, artists, dancers, visual artists, they bring a lot to the table besides a physical piece of work. So I'm psyched to see what they do with the space and how the neighborhood actually pulls up.
How important is this project to these artists, as you just named a whole host? Arts, it features a wide realm of people. How important is this project for individuals who, many of whom, have been out of work for many months now because of COVID?
Well, it's funny that you bring that up because, affordable housing overall is super important, obviously, right? But now, especially during COVID, and hopefully it'll be over by the time this is done in a year and a quarter or whatever it is, artists are suffering more than anyone. I couldn't say more than anyone. Obviously, restaurants and bars and things like that are suffering a great deal. And I hope that picks up once these are populated and people live there. But artists certainly even in times of non-pandemic issues, struggle in the very beginning because it takes a while to act. It's not like you get a job as an artist and all of a sudden your paintings are wildly popular and you make a lot of money. So I think that it gives them a little bit of a leg up so they can pursue some of the creative arts, which I agree we need more of everywhere. So, yeah, I think it's a great boon to them.
Thanks to Connections Community Support Program's Communications Director, Teresa Buchanan, and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on Arts Playlist. We wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and more on research into methane in salt marshes and its potential impact on climate change. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Salt marshes are known as a sink for global warming causing carbon. That's important for Delaware since the small coastal state has lots of these ecosystems. But what scientists didn't know is that they also hold another, even more potent greenhouse gas. That's the conclusion of research out of the University of Delaware. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Rodrigo Vargas, one of the researchers studying this, about how science missed this detail and what it might mean for mitigating climate change.
First of all, what is a salt marsh and how many does Delaware have?
Well, a salt marsh is a coastal wetland. Have you ever driven through the south, gone south to Delaware and looking at the coast and you see these grasslands and they are wet and then sometimes when the water goes, we have the high tide, the water goes up and you see these grasses just being submerged or just being kind of floating in the water. Those are the typical salt marshes that are in Delaware. And then when you probably drive back where you were and then you hit the low tide, then you see these mud areas. No, but you still see the grasses, but now they're not submerged. Those are the salt marshes that are in Delaware. So I would say that most of the coast in Delaware is covered with salt marshes, and they are very important for the state. They have many properties, as we will talk, in terms of what we call environmental services, such as storing carbon, protecting for storms, habitat for species, etc.
So as you mentioned, salt marshes are known for storing a lot of carbon in their sediment, but scientists didn't know that they also contain methane, which is another greenhouse gas that's even more potent in terms of its warming capacity.
Yeah, so you probably have heard about what we call the blue carbon. But what blue carbon is the carbon is stored in coastal ecosystems. And coastal ecosystems are mangrove forests, seagrasses, and salt marshes. So these ecosystems store large amounts of carbon because of many reasons. One is that they have a lot of productivity. Plants can produce a lot of biomass in these ecosystems. Also, because they are inundated, they have low oxygen in their sediments. So when this biomass drops into the sediments, then the microbial metabolism is reduced. What does this mean is that microbes don't have oxygen, and therefore they cannot chew this biomass as fast as microorganisms that are in an environment where they have a lot of oxygen. So because of that, they are kind of dormant, and they don't eat that fast, that biomass, and therefore that biomass accumulates in terms of carbon in the sediments. So we do know that they store a lot of carbon. Now, what is very interesting about these ecosystems is that I do not cover a large surface area in Delaware or around the world, but per unit area, they have a lot of carbon. What does this mean is that if you see a forest, you may see these big trees. They have a lot of biomass that is evident that you seeded it, but you might not see what is in the soil. With forests, you have large cover of forests around the world, but salt marshes, you don't have that much. And you don't see this big biomass above ground. So what is happening is that this carbon is stored in the sediments in the soil. So despite they have a low land cover, a low area, surface area, a low the representation in Delaware or around the world, they still contain a lot of carbon, mainly in their sediments.
So how did you and another UD researcher, Angelia Seifert, find methane in the salt marsh ecosystem?
So this is an interesting story. And it comes back to why we do science and how we do science. You start with a general question, and then it's like a puzzle. You start putting the pieces together. Sometimes when you have a puzzle, you can identify the pieces very easily, and you put it together, and you figure out what the puzzle is. But sometimes it's very hard to find the figure of what does that puzzle mean. So you start putting things together, expecting what to find, but sometimes you get in trouble. And that being in trouble makes it fun, makes it challenging, but also it's what takes into scientific discoveries. So we knew that in salt marshes, they store a lot of carbon. But also we have, when we start doing our research, we have to go back and read the literature and what is expected. So in freshwater wetlands, it's known that methane is produced. Now, in tidal wetlands, in salt marshes, higher salinity is expected that the metabolism of these microbes and the biochemical pathways that are available, they will not favor methanogenesis. And methanogenesis is just the production of methane. Yeah? So when we went there, we started looking and started measuring different greenhouse gases. And methane is one of those, but we also measure CO2, carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, it's part of the normal respiration process of any ecosystem. As we breathe in and out ecosystems and also breathe in and out. CO2 is coming from the atmosphere into the ecosystems, and the CO2 is produced via photosynthesis. Now you can produce biomass. And then when biomass is decomposed, CO2 is respired going back to the atmosphere. And we know that balance and we can measure that balance. But when we start measuring methane, we were not expecting to see that much methane fluxes. But when we start looking at the methane concentrations in the sediments, we were very surprised to see that the methane in the sediments, it was very, very large, unexpectedly high. So that is when the pieces of the puzzle start not matching. And this is what makes science fun. When something that you expect that it should not be there is there, and now you have to find the reason why is there. So Dr. Seifert's work identified that there are different biochemical pathways that microbes can take in order to produce methane, even if you have conditions that they do not favor the normal pathways of methanogenesis. And what happened is that there have not been that many measurements to corroborate these findings, and also the scientific community has overlooked some biochemical pathways about how methane can be produced in different ecosystems around the world.
So given methane's role in climate change, do you hope that your research will sort of add extra knowledge or incentives to governments or land management agencies to conserve salt marshes?
See, I believe that you have to see the ecosystems as a whole. So there are evident things that you see as part of an ecosystem. And there are things that are not that evident that are part of the ecosystem services of these ecosystems. So salt marshes are beautiful. They have aesthetic value. And that is always hard to value, you know, because you can ask someone, how much would you pay to see a salt marsh? How much you would pay to see your last sunset? No. But on the other hand, there are other environmental services that could be valued in terms of a unit. And the unit here is carbon. So there are theoretically carbon markets, and you could assign monetary value to a mass of carbon. So getting the right accounting of how much carbon is in the ecosystem, it is important and could be related to a monetary value of how much is worth, you know, or its value, a specific piece of land within an ecosystem. So for valuing the ecosystems in terms of carbon, meaning that you want to get the whole carbon balance, how much carbon is there, you have to account for many things. You have to account for the standing biomass. In this case, our grasses. It's not the same as a forest, as a tree, but the grasses have a lot of biomass. There are other parts of this accounting that are not that evident, and that is the below ground part. These grasses have a very thick and mass of roots. So there's a lot of biomass stored in those roots. there is also very deep sediments. They can go, you can go many feet there down into the soil, and then those sediments are rich in carbon. But also there are these exchanges that are not seen, which I have been referring as the breathing of the ecosystem, which is how much carbon is coming in and coming out in terms of greenhouse gases, such as CO2 or methane. So that balance between the gains and losses helps to get the right budget of how much carbon is stored in these ecosystems. One part that is very interesting of this study is that in most accountings, methane has not been taken for.
Right. So I guess to sum it up simply, if we're going to be measuring the value of an ecosystem, if we're going to have some complex accounting formula to measure it in dollars and cents, and if that has to do with its ability to store greenhouse gases, to mitigate climate change, knowing that there's methane in there through you and Dr. Seifert's research has increased the value of these ecosystems.
Yeah. And I am not suggesting that we now will have to measure methane in every ecosystem in the world. But it is important to for the accounting to take into consideration all the components that you were mentioning. One of the components is methane. And methane is difficult to measure, but because of the importance as a greenhouse gas and the greenhouse warming potential, it is something important to consider and will add value into these environmental services that these ecosystems in Delaware provide.
Rodrigo Vargas, Associate Professor in UD's College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sophia, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast on our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, as well as Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.